Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. And if this is your first Geekscape, what I like to do is sit down with storytellers. Usually they're pop culture. That's the stuff that I'm addicted to. So we're talking movies, video games, comic books, maybe some actors, maybe some video game voice actors, whatever you got that's pop culture. That's what I like to do. I like to find out about the stories they tell, why they tell them, where they come from. And if you've been on this ride with us for 15 years, then you know what to expect. If not, well, we've got a great show for you coming up. My good friend Liam O'Donnell, he's got a brand new movie coming out called Skylines. Now, you may not know this. Actually, if you've been listening to Geekscape this whole time, you will know this. I'm a Skyline fan. It's a movie that came out a couple years ago, about 10 years ago. This movie came out, and I went to the theaters to see it. I like sci-fi movies. I love alien invasion movies. And that was The Offering, and I went to see it, and I enjoyed it. You know what? Call me an Eric Balfour fan. I don't have a tattoo, but I do like the guy. I think he's charismatic, and I think he's a good lead. So I went to see this movie, and it was fun. And then I'm a super great like Frank Grillo fan. I don't know if y'all remember my review of Warrior, but I enjoy Frank Grillo. That was, I think, the first time I saw him. And he was in Beyond Skyline, which was the sequel to Skyline. So I watched that, and I liked it. And now we've got the third movie, Skylines, and Liam had a part in all three of them. So I was super stoked to have Liam on the show coming up. A little bit of housekeeping. We still have a brand new show on the Geekscape Network that would be called Bingetown TV, and The Mandalorian is finishing up this week. So I know the Bingetown kids are going to get together and they're going to talk about Mandalorian. So add Bingetown TV to your podcast apps. Go ahead and subscribe, share it with your friends. And if you like this show, go ahead and do the same for us. All right, let's bring Liam in. Let's talk some Skylines, and let's see what the story is. Liam, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed that intro. I didn't realize you were a Skyline 1 fan.
In one of the, yeah. Like, so in the crowd. It wasn't a full theater, Liam. But
No, I was probably at the theater because I was with like my wife and my dad and saw people leaving.
So Liam, you wrote and directed these last two Skyline movies, but yes. that first one is the Strauss brothers, and those guys were like the hot ticket in Hollywood at the moment. You know, they got an Alien versus Predator movie. I remember those guys were like the go-to effects dudes. Yeah. What was your involvement in that first Skyline movie?
Well, I started working for them doing just treatments, which would be like, so, you know, a record company would send them songs for music videos, and then the ad companies would send them storyboards. And that was really what their directing career was before they did features. And so I would take, you know, the song and pitch them ideas, and they'd pitch me back ideas, and I'd have a job to like write up this 3 to 5 page pitch. And that's how we kind of started working together. And then, you know, we would talk movies all the time. They're running this whole visual effects company, and I would just be like, "Hey, you want to go for a walk, and we'll talk about movies." And then I'd work on them, and I just was kind of constantly like chirping alongside of them on like trying to get movies off the ground. And so then AVP2 came, and I basically did what I was doing for the, you know, for their commercials and music videos for that, and worked on the pitch for them with that for months. And luckily, you know, the greatest thing at be like 24 years old and get to work. You know, that because I helped them so much with the pitch, they were like, you should come up on set and, you know, you can work on the previs and the trailer while we're filming and kind of be like a consultant liaison that would go in between, and, you know, because the studio would suddenly call and have notes on like a previs or pages the next day and they're on set. And so it was kind of this hybrid role that allowed me to get like my own like real film school there and work on a movie that had, you know, practical aliens in it. So it was really, you know, kind of a dream come true. And then for Skyline, it just came from, okay, they did that movie. That one actually made a lot of money, but wasn't the greatest critical reception either. And they had this apartment that Greg, the one of the brothers and owners of Hydraulics had bought this penthouse apartment overlooking LA. And we were like, it was right around like Paranormal Activity and Cloverfield and District 9. Those are all kind of in the ether, and you're looking out at this view and you're like, okay, like we should film something here. Obviously.
One of those places in Marina Del Rey.
Yeah. It's the building down there. The Cove.
It's in the movie. Yeah. It's right there at the end of the 90s.
We made a deal with the building, like a ridiculously low deal, to just like have access to every location there for a month. And so that's what we did. And so that's like the whole script is like written around the found locations of like, okay, there's a parking garage, there's a pool deck, there's a helipad. So it is kind of like, it's like this building's highlight reel or something. But yeah, that almost feels like
an indie movie, like the way you'd make an indie movie, but for like an estimated $10 million.
Well, but the actual live action shoot, like the initial live action shoot, was $500,000. So
that's insane.
All the money came in later, you know, like I think we would have finished it cheaper if we weren't bought by Relativity and then Universal, like really, like I think like a month after wrapping. We just showed them like the ending where they got sucked up from the helipad and some of the previs, and they were like, yeah, we can sell this. No, it was kind of a short a stint. And then it was like, okay, now we've got this. They started spending all this money on marketing. So the VFX and the sound were just top of the line on that movie. So it ended up, we did a reshoot for some of the first act stuff, and that ended up like bumping our DGA numbers up, and it became like a $10 million movie.
Yeah, what's insane, Geekscape, is a lot of the indie filmmakers who are listening to the show is when we make a film and then you send it to a distribution company, like that usually sometimes like the P&A usually sometimes doubles your budget. Like
if you count the P&A for Skyline, it's like a $50 million budget. It's crazy. But that money that they put in, because the movie didn't do great domestically. It did, like, by today's standards, if you do like 22 million and you're a hit, but 10 years ago and they spent like 30 something in P&A, it obviously was still in the red. But because they spent so much, it made so much money overseas, and it continued to have this like market saturation, like in DVD. So it was continuing to do pretty well in places that kept asking us about a sequel years after the fact. And so that was kind of where it was, around 2013, where I was like, I got to get on top of this sequel thing or it's going to slip through our fingers. And so that's when I said, like, I'll write this script for the sequel. We had a treatment all the way back from when Skyline came out. We had the treatment for Beyond Skyline, but I was like, I'm just going to go ahead and write this without, you know, spec it for you guys, but I want to direct. And they said to go for it. And so that's how that came about.
Yeah, what I love about it, and I actually like Beyond Skyline a lot, because the other thing that was kind of in the whole zeitgeist at the time was, remember Falling Skies, the USA show, or I think it was TNT? TNT had that show Falling Skies with Noah Wiley on it.
Yeah, I only watched the pilot like probably around the time of Beyond Skyline, because I think it came out, like maybe people were asking me to write a TV pilot, so I was kind of watching it for research, but I didn't watch it when it was on.
Yeah, I was a fan of that stuff. And like I said in the intro, like alien invasion stuff is always fun. It's always, I think that it does tie into the same kind of survival mentality post 9/11 that we're thinking when you watch something like Walking Dead, is like, okay, this over, you know, bearing force, you know, that forces humanity into like the into a corner and forces our survival. What would you do? And I think that is a genre that is really I think that it's kind of a fallout from a lot of the imagery that we've had.
I think people were asking. I mean,
Skyline, you literally had towers in it.
I know. I think at the time, I remember doing like a press day at Hydraulics, and then we like went out on the deck there, and we're talking with different critics, and there was one, I can't remember her name, was very smart female critic who was asking about that. And I remember kind of like not, you know, I didn't want to admit it. I think I was kind of like underplaying, like, no, this is more like a, you know, just turn your brain off, fun invasion movie. It's not, I kind of was, didn't want people to go in thinking that was like, I don't know, something that was conjuring up those images. But I think having then seen other movies that continue to do it, I'm like, yeah, it was definitely part of like the collective conscious at the time. Like it was definitely something about the feeling of waking up after like a party. It's like a normal day and the world is ending. And I think, I mean, that was pretty much a lot of people's experiences on 9/11. You know, I was like walking to class that morning and then got into class. I was at Boston University and they were like, "This is the day that we'll live in infamy, go back home and watch TV." And you're like, "Wait, what?" And then your brain starts to like slowly try to put things together and you have such limited information. So that was definitely, I think, part of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that if you aim for it, you're going to end up making something that's kind of gross. I think that what the successful pieces of the genre, Walking Dead being one of them, is, you know, Robert Kirkman was just like, "Hey, I want to make a movie that keeps going after the Romero movies end. After we have 2 hours of these people, they still got to live in a world that's kind of messed up. What happens then?" And I think that's something that you've continued with the Skyline movies, these last two, is, okay, yeah, you have a bunch of aliens that have invaded and taken out most of the population of the Earth. What happens next? And although it's not a series, you have two movies to do in. And, you know, the one tonal shift I'll say to Geekscapists who maybe watched Skyline or like, "Hey, that was cool. It was all kind of centered in one place. I don't know if it was for me." You do this thing, Liam, with the next two movies where you go so like fight heavy into this stuff that if I'm going to tell the Geekscapists that if you're a fan of movies that we pimp all the time, of the Raid films, if you're a fan of that stuff, if you really like I mean, I've got a Van Damme poster behind me.
I know.
Video recording of the show. Like, if you're a fan of a lot of that stunt choreography, I think that you did a great job on that second movie. Obviously, Frank Grillo is amazing. And then you brought in, like, Ico, who is in the Raid. Like, you started bringing in these Raid actors to be in the movie. That's, you know, that's got to be awesome and do some heavy lifting for you. You did it again on this movie. And, I wanted to know where that came from, that injection of sort of the hand-to-hand combat fighting that wasn't in that first Skyline movie, but is now part of the language.
Well, I mean, I guess where it all really came from was like, it was part of like, you're like, okay, I'm stepping into the director's chair. Like, what am I going to do different about it? And like, it's a lot of pressure. And I felt like, to me, my whole, like my mantra in Beyond Skyline was like, I just wanted like, I'm gonna put up everything that I love into this movie, and if it fails, like I'm gonna fail with my love. You know, that sounds like a crazy thing to say, but I was like, I love.
No, you it doesn't. You didn't know if you were gonna get another at bat.
I didn't know.
Does that make sense? That's not a slight. Like every time you go out, you don't know if you're gonna get another at bat.
And the reaction to the first Skyline was so negative that I was like, who knows? You know, I just want to put something out there that like I know I'm gonna unabashedly love without any compromise. I'm gonna cast actors that I'm huge fans of. I'm going to try to do like every little thing that of elements and put it together in places I haven't seen before. So like really the jumping off of that movie was Die Hard on an alien ship for me. I was like, what if John McClane got abducted by aliens? That was sort of the beginning of it for Frank's character and Johnny Weston's Trent. So that's kind of like the first half. And then it was like, where does the ship crash was always like something that we were trying to figure out. And, you know, there was, it was coming up with Laos. You know, my wife was born in Laos. And so that was definitely something that, you know, I learned from my time with her and stories with her. And her sister actually moved back to Laos. So there was a bunch of different things that I was thinking about with the minefields and with tunnel warfare from the Vietnam War that I thought could be like a really unexpected, cool way to go for the third act. Instead of going on the ship and having everything be so big to then kind of go actually smaller and more contained into the end until it breaks out into a big, you know, temple battle. So we're like, okay, let's go scout in Asia. And we met a really interesting company, Infinite Studios, that has stages in Singapore and across the bay in Batam. And so when we met them, like our first dinner, they were like, you know, we're friends with the Raid guys, Zico and Yayan. And it was, you know, do you think you'd want them in this movie? And it was like, wait, what? Like that could happen? And they're like, yeah. And oh, here's their manager, which was at the time was Gareth Evans' wife, Maya. She's in Jakarta.
Yeah,
she was in Jakarta this week. And so then we're like, emailed her and we're like, we're going to be in Jakarta tomorrow. Can we get lunch? And she's like, yeah, I guess so. So then we bought tickets to Jakarta, like went there. It was like, you know, we had to close that deal to make that happen. Cause it just, you know, just having that name float across the table, like it changed all the possibilities for the movie. And then once you meet them, they're just the greatest, like hardest working, most humble guys. And they were so pumped to add choreo to the movie. So like the back half had like, they fought an alien in a bunker and then they had a whole war, but it wasn't as martial arts heavy, obviously. And then, you know, I could never choreograph a fight like those guys could, like no one can, you know, that's you, right?
Yeah, that's me. They know all about me. They're coming to get okay. me.
So once they started adding it, and that was like even a thing where my creature designer, Alan Holt, you know, he's making these monster suits in Los Angeles at the time. And he thinks it's going to be kind of like the script. And I'm like, hey, have I showed you this choreo yet? And so I'm like, kicking the shit out of the air. And he's like, you know, so he had to build all new stunt heads that were like these foam heads that could take a punch. And so, yeah, that was like a gift from the movie gods on Beyond for sure.
And I mean, you've obviously seen those stories of Van Damme in the Predator suit, like early on. How Jean-Claude Van Damme was like in the Predator suit, and it looked like this giant, like praying mantis looking thing. They had like a really wonky suit, and the rumor is that he had just signed that contract with the Canon Films guys to do Cyborg and Kickboxer and stuff like that, and so he intentionally tanked the performance to get fired so that he wouldn't get injured in this thing, and that's a rumor. But once you start making these people, you know, I'm guessing they can't see too well in these suits, and then they got to do this choreography that's pretty exact, where you're blocking with camera's pretty close in some of these shots, and with performers who are moving around quite a bit. What were some of the challenges there? Because again, you're redesigning some of the script and like the choreo on the fly.
I mean, the first thing we shot for a fight with the alien was the scene where the alien comes down into the bunker and fights Eco and kills a bunch of his guys and then fights him one-on-one. And the first, like, take action, Anise Sherfwa was the stunt performer. He stands up on the stilts, takes one step forward, and just falls right on his kneecap from, like, you know, 4 feet up. And it was like, fuck. So those stilts were a real problem for us, and that ended up becoming, like, the bulk of our blooper reel over the credits of Beyond Skyline, because they just kept falling over all the time. And I tried them on at a gym, and I did it for like, you know, like a minute. And I was like, okay, I want to come down now. This is, it's kind of a weird, like you're not used to like lifting weight up with your leg. You know, you're used to.
No, you learn to skateboard when you're like 3 feet tall because your center of gravity is so low. If you start learning to skateboard when you're 6 feet tall, you're completely wonky.
Well, it's also like, you know, when you're in the gym, you're squatting, you're pushing down, but like, you're not generally like tying weights to your feet and lifting up. And that's sort of the feeling that it's like a lot of strain on your groin, and it just, it's not a great feeling in general. But those guys are all such, you know, gifted athletes, gifted stuntmen. But so for Skylines, that was one of the things that we did redesign. We brought in, we bought a new stilt system called DigiLegs that were kind of made to be on screen fully practically. And then we had to put in like skins around them and skin more of the leg. So in Beyond Skyline, the suits kind of ended at the knee, and they were all digital for the rest of it. And it ended up being kind of a real pain in the ass VFX wise, because the way that the hips move, you kind of couldn't keep as much of the practical leg as you wanted. So it ended up having to be like always replacing from the waist down. And that's just really expensive because it starts to become fully 3D CG instead of just a 2D composite. So, so I really wanted to nip that in the bud in this one. And so we did, and it turned out really well that like, you know, Trent is our alien character in this, who's part of the team. And, you know, he originated in Beyond Skyline, and now he's a full alien in Skylines. But yeah, like 90% of his leg shots are all on camera, which is cool.
Well, I want to talk about that, because in your first film, the first one, when you start having all these stunt, like these hurdles to get around, you know, and there's always going to be hurdles, but this one is actually pretty costly when you start realizing that there need to be digital solutions to this or redoing some of this. First time out of the gate directing, were you freaking out? How did you handle some of the stuff going on in your head when you start seeing these fires that need to get put out and you need to keep laying track down as the train is coming? What were some of the things that you'd tell yourself or your team to keep things moving?
It's a great question. No one's, I like this. So we're like, this is like a nuts and bolts filmmaking podcast. Yeah. The first movie, man, like Beyond Skyline, the first movie directing, I mean, it was a real, like, getting thrown into the deep end of the pool with weights strapped around your neck, because, you know, the first day we're filming in this rice paddy in Indonesia, with Frank and Eco, and we have the whole cast coming together, and it starts raining right away. It was like every day in Indonesia in the jungle, we'd get rained out for hours. And it kept adding days. We kept falling behind schedule. Sets would get kind of swallowed. There's scorpions and snakes that you kind of like, you step on it and like, you don't want everyone to see that it's right there. So it was really treacherous. I was just so happy that, no one got injured in that fight, because, you know, we had choreographed and rehearsed the fight really well. But then once you get to the set and it rains right before the fight, the footing was so difficult. And we have literally Frank picking Eco up, throwing him. We did have a stunt double for when Frank gets like his neck slammed through a hut. But, the stunt double, I was worried for him. That was kind of all the biggest fears of everything at the beginning. And then Greg Strauss, who was the producer who directed the first one, was kind of my backstop, helping me. He was shooting plates in the second unit. Hydraulics is like, whole server goes down like 3 days into the shoot, and he has to go back to put that fire out in LA. So then it was like, okay, now I'm really handling this all. You know, I had my producing partner, Matthew Chouse, but it was still like, it was a big movie for even just two people to be like putting out all the fires all the time. But yeah, like I just had like the confidence of, I guess, just this naivete in a lot of ways. I'm just like, it has to happen. It's going to work out. And if anyone gets in my way, like, the only thing I'll do is I'll just keep out working people. So every time there would be, obstacles, I would just, keep going. And that happened in that movie all the way through post, because we couldn't build this huge set in the second act that was supposed to be all in camera in Indonesia. But to actually get Rock and Roll Trust to the stage there was going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, because it wasn't available there, to make everything safe so that we could put the cast on wires, because we have, cast members hanging upside down in alien cocoons and people jumping and fighting, big, huge tentacle monsters. So that couldn't be made safe. And we had to then shoot it later back in LA, all on green screen, which, like, was a pain in the ass just to shoot, because, it's to so much action in such a small space, and you're kind of having to explain to everybody everything and not really working from the real set. But then afterwards in post, it ended up being like 500 more shots than was like we ever thought was going to be in the movie. So that movie ended up just stretching on and on. So when people are like, and then it came out 7 years later for the sequel, I started shooting that movie at the end of 2014. Then we had to break for Frank to do another movie. We finished it in May in Toronto. And then after that, it was like, we did so many VFX for about 2 years, and then we kind of finished it early 2017, but Vertical didn't want it to release it until Christmas. So it was like, it was just a marathon, really. So there's so many different kind of points within that movie where I felt like, I had my back against the wall, even when we did a re-edit of it towards the end. The new editor came in, he was more, he's a veteran action guy, Sean Albertson. And, he's kind of looking at me as this young punk. He's going to show me. And I kind of was just like, we're going to become best friends and we're going to finish this movie together. And he was like, okay. And we did, because I just kept showing up every day. And I just kept being like, he had leaned out. He had taken out one of the fights, which was introduction fight with the neck stab. And I just kind of kept like doing like a little Chinese water torture, like a drip a day, until finally we found a way to put it back in at the last second. And he was like, it's okay. And I was like, what are we doing? What are we doing here? People are here to see, Eco stab people action in the neck. They're here for him. Like, why would we not have this in the movie? So, that that was sort of like the only thing I can do is not quit and keep working as hard as I can, because you know, like you said, you never know if you're going to get another shot at it.
Would you suggest next time starting, just because new crew, new, you gotta establish that rhythm, and sometimes it takes several days to establish that rhythm. Would you suggest with just doing like some of the conversational scenes early on, just be like, all right, let's do some basic coverage with some oneers here and there, because we got to make sure the team knows how to work together before we start doing these crazy bigger set pieces.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly feel like the rain season
would allow that.
I think the producers were like, this fight's not bondable. Let's do it before the bond on the movie actually closes. Let's do all this crazy shit up front. And then, which is exactly what happened. I don't think the bond closed till like March, and we were there in December. So it was like, go get all this crazy shit that like no one's ever going to sign off on.
There's that. Yeah, Geekscape is where we're making music videos. Always shoot the band first in case you get thrown out of the location. Okay, like make sure if everything goes tits up, you at least have the band done, and then moving on.
It's interesting about thinking about schedules and what to do first. I definitely think, especially working with like your lead first in a simpler scene, is a great way to start off. And I think that's more of what we did in Skylines. You know, like we shot the green screen stuff at the beginning of the movie that was a continuation of Beyond, with just Lindsay and the suit actor for Trent. And it was like a half day, like, let's just, you know, cause we only had two fully green screen sets. So it was like a half day. We even didn't call it a day. It was like an X day. And that was the first thing that we did. And it was great because it was like, I could see that she came in so locked in. It was, you know, I'd only worked with her with one day on Beyond Skyline, but she was like, we're talking about eyelines and where she wanted to look and pacing out the scene. And she's like, I really feel like I need to look at my brother right now. And like, you look at the big guy in the suit and you're like, oh yeah, she really believes that's her brother. This is going to work. This is amazing. So yeah, I definitely would do it that way.
Yeah. And Lindsay Geekscape is like, she was on, this is Lindsay Morgan. She was on the 100. So she knows how to do the action stuff. She knows how to do the choreography, and she knows how to do it like at a TV pace too, which is much different than doing it on a film pace where you have probably a bigger crew and a little bit more time to do it. You know, it had to have been advantageous to have Lindsay come in with the mindset of, like you said, if I'm not locked in with my character, if I'm not locked in, we may be going at a pace that doesn't allow me to play catch up. And that's really huge. That's a huge advantage to you. And then again, like you said, doing just simple, you're talking about this, your Lord of the Rings intro with the spaceships.
Yes.
I'm gonna call it the Lord of the Rings intro.
That's what I call it. I call it James Cosmos does the Lord of the Rings intro.
Because first off, when I'm watching the Lord of the Rings intro, I was like, Liam, you know you're cheating me right now. You know, you're like, straight up, you, first off, I'm just gonna call Skylines Skyline 4, because there's a Skylines 3 that you gave us in the first like 5 minutes of Skylines, and you straight up were like, yeah, this happens, enjoy. Yes. And I was like, Lord of the Rings, like, was it like 10 seconds left in the football game and you're just trying to chuck it up the field as fast as possible?
There's still room to explore that time period. You know, if that were to come down, the road, because I have fleshed out the stuff that happens in between the movies, and I really, not to jump ahead, but that would be something I'd love to do. But yes, it is like, I feel like, what was it, X-Men Days of Future Past kind of did that, where all of a sudden you're like, wait, was there another movie in between this? Did I miss something? What is this a sequel to?
We're in the future now.
Yeah, right.
Magneto and Charles are getting along.
I kind of love that shit. So that was a little bit of like, let's do the Lord of the Rings kind of like consolidate. And I also tried to just put the lampshade on it where he's just like, after that, it gets complicated because it's, wasn't some pre-designed trilogy. It's kind of, you know, each movie's been this different evolution. And then if you're actually going back and being like, okay, what are the rules of this superhero character? How do I create her origin in a nice, like, easy to digest mythology? I kind of just had to crush it all together there in like 2 minutes and then get you into, you know, this new adventure.
And again, Geekscape, if this is your first Skyline movie. But I know we're joking about the Lord of the Rings intro and how, you know, original Lord of the Rings did it in the first movie. Liam's kicking it in the third because he's just rocking that way. You know, it does give you what you need. So if you just decide to check out this one, which I actually suggest you check out all three, but if you just check out this one, that's not a, you know, he does give you a pretty good Cliff's Notes there at the beginning. One thing, a Geekscape's Bold T is asking, Liam, do you read comics? What is your favorite book on filmmaking? Before you answer that, there's a really great comic called Ascender, and I think it got optioned by, I think it might be a Netflix or an Amazon series, but the writer who does it, I'm blanking on it, but what Ascender is like in the future, or Descender is the first one. Ascender is the one going on right now, but in the future, like, robots are outlawed because these giant robots showed up and just started killing people, like giant. Oh. And they're in, I'm just preparing you for this. They're called Harvesters in that one. And they're huge, like Galactus sized robots. And they show up. And because of that, a lot of our assistant robots and companion robots and things like that are outlawed, and they're like hunting down robots. And it's about like this guy who's young, you know, he outgrew him, but his young companion robot was left like on this planet, and kind of finds out, like, a little bit of Pinocchio story, kind of finds out his autonomy and his bigger purpose to kind of save everybody from the potential return of these giant robots. And as I'm thinking about it, I'm just like, okay, it is a similar theme. Not that it's,
No, but yeah.
I definitely recommend it because it's a super cool story. And again, it's very different than yours because this one is a future society. It's an intergalactic federation. It's got a lot of different things going on. But the whole idea,
Harvester is a pretty common name. I didn't have names for, I didn't even have the word alien in any of the first two scripts, really.
But that's what they're doing in the first movie. They're definitely harvesting people. Yeah,
exactly. So it just became one of those things where it's like, I had weird names. I had, like, in the second one, the evil alien was called the Shepherd. Like, she was the shepherd of this flock, but no one's going to ever say that word. So Harvesters was just a very kind of simple, like you said, it's what you see them doing. So it might as well be the name.
Do you read comics and, like, where do you start?
I was a huge comic fan. Like, so I'm 38 now. So, like, when I was like 10 to about, you know, 15 was really more my heyday, which was like the Image Comics explosion heyday of like Spawn and, you know, Todd McFarlane, you know, the Sideways issue was like, those were all like my touchstones of like, oh, I got really into that run. I was really into X-Men. I actually like Darkhawk, which everyone makes fun of me of, but I really like, people are like, would you like Darkhawk to
make and Shadowhawk and all that stuff? Was it
Darkhawk was the Marvel version. Shadowhawk was the Image version, but the Image version was kind of a ripoff of Wolverine.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah, yeah, totally.
And
that was Jim Valentino's thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like Max and Pitt and all those, you know, Sam Keith. So that's kind of where my comics, like, you know, heyday came from. And then when you start, you know, coming out into Los Angeles, in the early 2000s with that huge, like, graphic novel boom, you know, with 300 and then Watchmen and stuff, I was reading a lot then. The last comic that I really, really loved, though, it was a couple years back, was the Dark Horse's, like, the Conan series that they did, which were like,
they did an awesome job.
I bought every single one of them. And
Kurt Busiek's artwork, and that dude, the guy who was the guy who was doing that artwork that Kurt Busiek was writing. And it was like Kerry Nord.
It was the best, like, storytelling of Conan. Because I've read all the short stories. I had an opportunity to, like, kind of consult on that reboot before it went to Nispel. And so I read every single short story, and I read all of those Dark Horse adaptations. And I felt like, from every piece of media, I felt like that was the most perfect. It was the most perfect kind of blend of, you know, the fantasy with the savage kind of, like, ideology of that character, which is always kind of annoys me in the movies, is that they always make them revenge movies, because they think that's the only way that, like, his harder edges will be palatable for an audience. And, you know, he doesn't really even have a revenge backstory in the original stories.
Yeah, and I thought, he's an explorer. He's like a thief and an explorer.
He's more like the man with no name, like a Clint Eastwood, or even like there's an element of Jack Sparrow of like that, this like agent of chaos that kind of can play people against each other. You know, like Yojimbo, like he's got this intellect where like people will always hire him for a gig, but they're going to try to fuck him and he's going to fuck them worse. And he's going to get away with the money and the women and the food. And I'm like, that's such an awesome character. I just wish that, you know, in movies that they could do it like that instead of have it be always, you killed my parents and I got to come get it, which is like, I fucking love, you know, the Arnold's Conan the Barbarian. So I think that that kind of made sense for that time. But now if you were doing a new one, that was at least what I was urging at the time, was to call it like Conan the Sumerian and to have it be like he's Clint Eastwood. He's the man with no name, but he's a fucking barbarian and no one listened to me.
I like that take way better. And I used Kerry Nord's artwork as a reference when I put out, I have a character named Super Action Man. When I put out a comic on that Kerry Nord artwork was my like reference. And I got to tell you straight off the bat that I was reading Avengers this week and who did the artwork? I was like, who's doing this artwork? It looks familiar. Dave Keown, who did Hulk and then Pitt. Like, I haven't seen this kind of artwork in a while. Oh, it's Dave Keown. I got it.
There's a new series with Conan that's like Savage Avengers that I've saw online, but I haven't bought it yet. But it looks like right up my alley. But
it's kind of fun. Gary Dugan, who's the writer, he's been on the show Geekscapist. He's in charge of that one, but I do recommend just the straight up Conan stories that Marvel's doing. I think they're doing a good job. As you know, it's the best stuff since that Dark Horse stuff that you're talking about that Kurt Busiek started with Kerry Nord. I love that stuff. I think it's incredible. As far as getting into film school beyond work, you know, once you're out of Boston, you know, Boston University, like what are you doing? Like when you're working with these guys, you get the job. I've written a million treatments. We get it here in LA. Like it's just, you're constantly at bat. And you really, Geekscape is, if anything, your creative, one thing it does is it builds up your, the kind of creative, just level you have to stay at for a long time.
Yes.
Because you exhaust your mental force like really quickly. By like 8 PM, you're just like useless.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got really, really lucky because they, they were like, they had this huge visual effects company, and then this their directing career was like this side thing. So they needed to delegate a lot. So they delegated a lot to me. So it was kind of like going to director school and learning that part of it, but you know, mainly from a writing perspective, but. Because they bought their own cameras, they bought their own lenses, and eventually we had stages, we could just shoot things. And there would always be like, okay, well, if this is the pitch, like it around 2009 was when we started just shooting our own pitch trailers. Like Skyline, we shot a pitch trailer of that with, you know, with our friends who were, you know, aspiring actors. You know, like during the Thanksgiving Day break of 2009, and having that to go with the treatment and writing the script and having concept art and hydraulics is what got that initial 500,000 in to shoot it. So yeah, that was kind of the like the DIY of what those guys did instilled in me. And I was kind of, I had come from that from when I first came out there. I was working at like a local pothead production company where they would pay me like in pot and marijuana and like occasionally $100 a week and like
maybe turn into something.
It was just like but it would be like, okay, here's like a makeup infomercial. Just go to the, you know, go over to their place and film these women talking about their like makeup line, which is like but it was enough responsibility that I had to like stand up and set up three cameras and say action for the first time. Well, I think my voice cracked. I was like, action. And so like, it's better to have that experience there than trying to, you know, go and be in a real set and being like, okay, I need to get better at this. And so that
you didn't want to have the makeup lady start punching each other and like, you didn't want to start doing the choreography there.
It's such a great, I probably would have, you know, actually, you know, had the business taken off if I just said like, okay, now you guys beat the shit out of each other. But no, at the time I was like, yeah, I was so scared. to do anything. But it's always just that feeling of like, you know, there's a little bit of that, like no one really knows what they're doing, especially when you're starting out. And I think it's better to like reach across the aisle than to always be trying to reach up. You know, like you get people that are like on social media that contact you and they're like, you know, what's my advice for becoming a filmmaker or becoming an actor? And it's like, you kind of have to like make movies with your friends and the people that you know, within your social group. It's like, you can't just walk in and all of a sudden, you know, you're going to be on this movie set, like just because you're a fan of them on social media. That's just not really how it works. It's like everything I started out with, it was like filming, you know, with my roommate. And we actually filmed on the Skyline helipad before the movie did, because, you know, we were doing like this sci-fi super soldier thing where we had like, paintball armor on ourselves and all this stupid sci-fi LEDs. And we had like fake paintball guns on the rooftop up there illegally. And so I was like, yeah, that's going to be a good location for a movie, because we'd already kind of done our own little DIY short that ended up being a little thing we put online. And I feel like nowadays, I mean, that's back in like 2008, 2007. Nowadays, you know, that we were shooting like 24p. On those kind of, that was like the big breakthrough, right?
Remember how excited we were to do that?
It felt like we were real movie makers, you know?
When the HGX 100 came out, yeah. And suddenly you weren't shooting on mini DV. You were just like, yeah. What is this?
Yeah.
This is amazing. We can shoot forever.
Yeah. And so, and you know, my roommate was really good. He still is. He did actually, Matthew Santoro's his name. He did all of the holograms, like the moving holograms in the ship in Skyline. So he did all these After Effects stuff on our footage back then. And it was a really exciting time because people were so like, I guess in a way, like easily impressed by visual effects. Like if you could do that stuff, everyone's like, holy shit, how do you guys do that? But now there's like, you know, there's all these kind of plugins and it's a little bit simpler to do that kind of basic stuff. But it really was about kind of like just kind of failing and trying over and over again. And I definitely lucked into that situation where those guys were open to delegating and letting people kind of play with their toys.
And Geekscape is, I think Kevin Smith also says this. He's like, dude, just make a movie where you are. Like, you don't have to move to LA. You don't have to move to New York, especially now with all the, you know, I've told you a million times that John Cassavetes would have killed for the camera that's on this phone. And you can just go make a movie, just do it. And like Liam said, like you will go up in parallel with each other. You will climb with each other and look out for each other. And I think that's way better than like the cutthroat ladder climbing where you get to the top and you realize you don't have any friends anymore.
No.
Like, yeah. Now you're just a commodity for somebody. And yeah. When they're done with you, you're done. Podcast.
Yeah, no, that all that stuff definitely happens too. But I even think like I feel like that like me on the first movie, I directed with Beyond Skyline, and you're working with this really great veteran actor like Frank, you're like kind of holding on for dear life because he knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of like, you know, great, I think we're moving on. But getting that experience was fantastic. But it was like to then work with Lindsay, who had never been the lead of a movie before, who'd had all this great TV experience. But it was like, it was a lot more collaborative from my end because I'd be like really working on where we're picking our spots, because she is so good at like getting emotional or fighting back. She's got all this fire. And it's kind of like, the difference, I think, especially when you're in like an ensemble show like the 100, is that like when you're up to the bat, you got to like hit it out of the park each time. And I'll just be like, you're the lead of this movie. Like you actually have to lose scenes, which is an interesting thing to learn. Like, no, like you kind of just fucked up. Like your character just fucked up. If you try to beat these guys in the next scene instead of let them come at you and like show some vulnerability, then I think we're going to lose the audience here. So there'd be all these
add colors to it. You can't just be at one note the entire time.
Yeah. So, and that was something that was really, really rewarding to work on with her, and she killed it. But it was like, it was a like that saying, like reaching across instead of up. It was that more of like, okay, we're kind of both in the same part of our career and we're trying to figure this out together.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, Liam, like, you know, this movie in Geekscape, as you'll watch it, it leaves a little bit open for a fourth movie, definitely hints at a fourth movie. Is that something you're interested in, or do you have somebody doing your mail right now that you're going to give the fourth movie to who's writing your treatments at this point?
No, I don't have it. My situation is not quite as I have no ability to delegate a thing, unfortunately. I wish I did.
It's a hustle, and people, yeah, I think, get the wrong idea of it. And
I was just talking to someone about this last night, because I think, you know, certain people have a wrong idea, and it's a weird thing for us to talk about, because you don't want to complain about being a middle class filmmaker. It's like, what the hell is that? Like,
I tell people, it's not laying brick. I was like, I'm not laying brick, but at the same time, we're constantly hunting.
And a lot of the parts of the job would definitely be like better if you had millions of dollars, right? Like, it's hard to tell my wife that I've got to go away for 3 months and she's going to take care of four kids, and I'm not coming back with a $2 million check. You know what I mean?
Like, they're all yours. All those kids are yours.
They're all mine. And I feel bad whining about it, but it is.
Water on them and they start multiplying. Like, how did you get that many kids?
I'm a slow learner. It takes me a long time to figure out how this stuff works, but. Yeah, but that was one. And then also, like, where I'm at the point right now with this movie where, you know, we've done the festival circuit for 2 months and got a lot of great reviews. And now, like, all the mainstream normal venues are starting to review it. And some, they're just like, you know, it's obviously not the movie for them. And they're going to be really negative about it. And you're like, you know, what other job do I get just like shit on in public? like no one else like does the job where then like someone comes into the public square and is like, you fucking suck. And if you say anything back, you're a fucking thin-skinned baby. Just take it. And like, it's just a weird job. And so, like, I guess it's like, it is like, you just, yeah, it's like, you know what would be great is if I were making a lot of money. That would be the great thing to go with all of this weird, unique stress. Whereas, yes, I'm able to provide, you know, for four kids in where everyone's doing great. But it is like, it's a weird thing to complain about and try to explain to people. It's like, I'm kind of living like a normal mid-management salary lifestyle, but then you have this weird added stresses of crazy travel, constant hustle, a lot of stress, anxiety, everything could be falling apart. There's not that like security of like, oh, I've got a 10-year, I mean, I have tenure, or I'm going on retirement. Like, no. It's all this. Oh, just, yeah. It's not a job for anyone. Especially nowadays when we talk about mental health, like that's actually one of the things when I'll talk to younger people and they want to get into filmmaking, I'm like, I don't know how to, does anyone even talk about this? Because it's, you have to really be, you know, have some sterner stuff or a great support system, because it is pretty much designed to like run on your anxiety. The whole thing runs on your anxiety.
In Geekscape, what Liam's saying is actually really important, because what we're doing when we do it right, when it's not handed to us, when we're doing it right, is we're creating something out of nothing, which is like modern alchemy, which is, you know, if you want that safety that Liam's talking about, like, go ahead and think about med school or law school. Because we're making something out of nothing in the instrument. And I was talking about this earlier, that you need this kind of high, you know, capacity for it, is you're making something out of nothing, and it's very exhausting. And if you're doing it right, like Liam's saying, you got to take it out from the inside. Because if you watch this Skylines movie, you're going to see that Liam is, I mean, he's like dropping stuff in the script that's like shout outs to some of his favorite movies. Like, I think I know what his shelf looks like. There's a couple Aliens references, like straight up off the bat. But I'm just like, yeah, whoa, all right. But because you're drawing from yourself, this sense of rejection that you get when you do get rejected, and you will get rejected, it can just be crippling. Our last film, Geekscapes, that you helped us fund, Chasing Fletcher Allen, like it got into a festival in India in May, and Heidi was like, are y'all having the festival? Because we've been in a few festivals that are all digital this year, as Liam's experienced, and they got back to us, yes, we're actually having the festival in May in India, and Heidi's like, can we go, like, let's go. And I'm like, no, we're not going to India. Like, this is not the year to go to India with India having the second highest COVID numbers in the globe. Like, I'm not spending, like, that's an expensive trip, first off. I'm not going, like, no, we're not going to India. We're going to shoot a video tonight, and we're going to We're going to send them a nice video to say thank you for playing our film. We hope you enjoyed it. I hope this is subtitled. Like, that is what we could do, because, you know, it's tough, Geekscapists, and you got to love storytelling. You got to be like Liam is talking, like we're getting here through a lot of coffee deliveries.
Yes. Yeah. And I love it. And especially this past year, like we wrapped editing in February. So it was like perfect timing that I was in London. We wrapped it like, okay, we're going to lock for visual effects. All the VFX started in March as the lockdown happened. So, you know, we did like 1200 VFX shots over 8 months in lockdown. And it was crazy, but that was my favorite part of the year, to be honest with you. I liked waking up and looking at those VFX and seeing my budget dwindle down and realizing that I was going to have to pay for some of it myself. But like, yeah, it still was like I miss making the movie. I think that's where I am right now. Like, it was actually like a mourning process to finish it. And now it is that feeling of like it's coming out and you're getting this feedback, and some of it is so amazing and people completely connect with even like the tiniest nuances of things you're putting out. And other people, it's like, how are these two people watching the same movie?
It's such a specific audience. It's actually not. This is the reality.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just reality. It's like, you know, half the country thinks, you know, the two different people won this election. Like, there's multiple realities that we're living in right now. So you kind of can drive yourself crazy. But yeah, I just being real, I've kind of been trying to talk about that a little bit more lately, because even when I meet up with other directors and get coffee, I don't know if this is a faux pas, but I'll always ask them, like, so how are you doing for money? Like, what's going on with, like, how do you make ends meet? A lot of the time you can kind of tell that it's family, you know, that they have some type of family connections, because you're like, well, dude, you haven't done a movie in like this many years. Like, you know, a lot of times they're doing great and they're killing it on commercials, and that's subsidizing everything. Or they have other jobs, you know, like,
oh my God, Geekscapists, if not for editing, this year it would have been brutality. But I had an actor cast. I had coffee with him. We cast him, a lead in a film. He was the lead in a blockbuster last year. We cast him March 8th, March 12th. That movie's not shooting this summer.
Well, that I thought of people like you, and that was actually what made me feel like counting my lucky stars.
Meanwhile, my producer George Callert wrapped the movie the Monday before March. March 12th was a Thursday. He wrapped the movie Monday, and he's lucky as hell. He had one reshoot day that he was able to do without actors that he did sometime in July, and that movie's pretty much done based on a graphic novel. That's my producer with another director. Geekscapists, I love having people on the show to talk about the real stuff and actually talk about the mental stuff.
Is killer, yeah.
It's 100% of it. And if you like it, my buddy Adam Mortimer, who we were talking about being on the production company together, that's an episode or two ago. He did this movie that just came out with Joe Manganiello.
Arch Enemy. I met him in Indonesia. He actually came to the stages where we were filming Beyond Skyline and was scouting them for another movie at the time. I haven't seen him since. We both live in LA. So I actually reached out to him last week to congratulate him on Arch Enemy and was like, how is it that we met like 6 years ago in Indonesia and we've been living in LA and we haven't, you know, met? And he was like, dude, I know. Like, you know, so we made a bro date to kind of trade war stories as soon as it's safe to do so.
Oh my God! Can I hitch a ride on that one? Because Geekscape, you heard us catch up 2 weeks ago. I think Adam and I checked our we were on the same we were in the same production company like for years, and we just checked our texts and we were like, dude, we haven't talked since 2013. I have your number. Why did we go through PR to do this? Liam, dude, you're always welcome on Geekscape. This is our kind of movie. Forget the critics who are like, oh, I'm sorry. This isn't like they're writing a review with their pinky out. Like, just forget that.
Right.
Like, well, this is our kind of movie, Geekscapists. It comes out this weekend. You can go see it at the drive-in. You can see it on VOD. You can see it wherever you get any of this like 2020 content. But go see it at the drive-in. This is like actually a perfect drive-in movie, I think.
I think so too.
And of course, we're going to have Liam back whenever he like does the next one. You know, the Heartfelt Countryside movie. That's not no effects ever. No effects, no stages.
Just you know, no one will hire me unless the movie has like either a creature in it or a decapitation. Like no one's gonna fucking hire me unless. And guess what? I probably would add them if they hired me on a movie that didn't have it. So I kind of, that's another little piece of advice I feel like I've been taking is like kind of typecast yourself that like the next movie I'm trying to get off the ground is a creature movie, but it's a World War II setting, Arctic. Very kind of serious, bleak, dread-filled. So it'd be a change of pace, but like the financiers can look at the package and still go, oh, yeah, that's a creature guy. He'll handle that, and that makes them feel better. It's like always trying to come at it from like, what's going to make it easy for the guy with the money or the girl, whoever with the money, to say yes? And how do I, you know, make it so easy for them to just be like, oh, yeah, this is a no-brainer? And that's instead a really of like, point. Sometimes it's not about presenting it as the most creative, amazing thing possible and presenting it as like, this is the thing that will make you feel the most comfortable by giving us the money to make it.
And Geekscape is, again, like, I know that Hollywood sounds like it's a place where you just hit home runs, where home runs are the only thing that count. But like this, like life is so much made out of just course corrections. And just remember that when man first got to the moon, they were only on course for 10% of the voyage. The entirety of it was course correcting. Okay. So don't get deflated. Don't get bummed out. Just remember that this is part of that process. And, you know, like take the course corrections as victories because it's a tough road, dude. Liam, thanks so much, dude. I wish you luck this weekend with the movie. Thank you for coming on Geekscape. And that is an open invite, dude.
Anytime. I'd love it, man.
Yeah. Of course. Geekscapists, tell your friends to subscribe. We got much more of this. We got a couple more episodes, I think, coming out before the end of the year, and we've already got a couple people booked for January, so it's fun. Well, you know, who knows, maybe I'll just never make a movie again and I'll just keep talking to you on the internet. If so, you're gonna benefit.
Your mental health will benefit, you know that.
Your mental health will benefit, Geekscapists. My mental health will probably be in the crapper, so leave me a 5-star review to kind of buoy it a little bit. Thanks again, and Geekscapists, over and out. Don't hate, create. Peace.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.